We are sitting in not sunny Manitoba this time, unlike our last interview with Dr. Liebfried. And this is the second go-round. We're conducting it on May 13th in the afternoon, 2011. And I will just start by asking you to introduce yourself and give your date of birth for our records, please.
I'm Jim Liebfried, and I was born March 16th, 1931.
Great. And to follow up on the second interview, we ended it, or the first interview, we ended it quite abruptly in listening to it, because there were a couple of things that you mentioned that you had gone on to after your career at the Canadian Wheat Board, and that was involvement with the Grain Transportation Agency and study on rail line abandonment, two very important parts of the history of the grain trade. So could you refresh my memory on when you left, or what years were you at the Wheat Board?
From October 1964 until the end of December 1985.
Okay.
So 21 years.
21 years.
3 months.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And how did you come to get involved with the Grain Transportation Agency?
Well, I've been very much involved with grain transportation part of the time when I was at the Wheat Board, and the revamping of the delivery quota system and of the setting up of what we call the block shipping system, which involved the companies and the railways and the terminals and all that, and trying to improve the efficiency and the throughput of the system. So I had a lot of experience with them, and I knew very well the people that were with the new Grain Transportation Agency, Peter Thompson and his people. So
what was the history of the grain transportation industry? How did it, how and why did it come about?
The agency?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there might be others who can tell you more about the politics behind it.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was some feeling in there that the Wheat Board was doing too much of the direction of the rail transportation in particular, and that maybe there should be an independent body who was in there and allocating the overall car supply and the overall management of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's probably why it was established. And I think after a few years they found out it wasn't operating much differently. And I think much of that went back. It was pretty well ended, and then it went back, I think, to the Wheat Board, much of the same coordinating functions.
And
they also had certain special projects they worked on, as well as the day-to-day or week-to-week coordination.
Mm-hmm. And was it one of these special projects that you were involved in?
Yeah, a couple of them.
Okay.
And one was the rail line abandonment. We had six branch lines in Western Canada that we used as sort of guinea pigs, I guess. Two in Alberta, two in Saskatchewan, two in Manitoba. Three involved the CPR and three involved the CNR. And what it was we went in there, and I was the chairman of the committee, and I had some specialists from each of the railways on it, and a certain of the rail company people. And we would go in and we set up a local committee then, of mainly farmers in the area. And we could go through what are the alternatives to the system that existed. Whether if you abandon the line, where could you maybe truck it to, or could you load cars directly, and things like this. And what was the best way to go about this, and what was the cost associated? What were the extra trucking costs, highway problems? And we covered a whole gamut of things. So we would meet with this committee, and they would give us their questions and the things they were concerned about and what options they wanted to look at. And then we would come back, and our committee, or the working group, sort of put all the numbers together, then come back and have another meeting with them and explain how this we were shifting out. And after we had several meetings like that, then we had public meetings in which we explored these possibilities before the group, and just said, this is it, we're not giving you the answers, this is what the numbers we've got, and this is the best we've got.
Mm-hmm. Can you recall some of the names of the people from the railways who were involved in that that group? The reason I ask is that if we take a look at our the expertise areas of the various people that we've interviewed, we're a little shy on the railway side, so we need to make some contacts. And also, I guess, just to...
A couple of the main fellows who used to work with her are dead.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, that's what we discovered.
Yeah, Jim Harris and Bob Shipp. Bob Shipp was CPR. Jim Harris was the CNR. There were some younger fellows. There's Bob Martinelli on the CPR side. Paul Earle, he worked sometimes for the CPR, sometimes for the UGG, and sometimes for the GTA. And then he's sort of teaching and doing some research since then.
Mm-hmm.
He was involved in some of those. But Tommy Cassisa, he was with the Cargill. He was on some of those committees. And Mike Chomsky was with the government, federal government, on transportation. I'm not sure just which department he's in now. He did a lot of the work in putting the numbers together on all these different alternatives. And I say Mike, I think he's probably still with Agriculture Canada, or maybe Transport mm-hmm. Canada, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. What was the impetus for even considering the branch line decommissioning?
Well, it was trying to improve the efficiency of the system, I guess, and did. We had gone into getting a hopper car fleet built up, and you wanted to turn those as fast as possible rather than taking them down a branch line and leaving them sit there a week and then pick them up again. And also some of the old tracks would take a lot of work to keep them up to handle these kind of tonnages and things like this. So, and they were, the companies were also consolidating and trading off points here and there and trying to build up bigger loading units. So all of these things were going on at the same time, and they wanted some direction as to what lines were going to stay and which ones weren't going to stay. And the federal government also wanted to know, you know, where their money should be going or not. And so these are, I'd say, six sort of trial areas that we went into and worked with. And some of them got, there were different solutions came up, which the government had to decide later. We didn't make any decisions on our committee. We just set out the mm-hmm. the facts and what the opinions were, and vote reports.
A couple of things rising from your comments were, it seemed like a very difficult thing to deal with, because you would think that, particularly with the producers, the farmers, that there was no solution other than status quo. Is that true?
Oh, that would start out that way, I'm sure, in each of these cases. Each one wanted to keep their own elevators and their own branch line. Yeah, they were very strong on that in most places, but they also knew things were going to change, and so they were very interested in knowing what were the other possibilities, and if the elevator was gone, if they would get paid for trucking to another place. Oh, I'd say there was a very informative sort of thing. The meetings, yes, when we had the public meetings in, some of them would get a little hot and discussions would go, but you'd explain to them that we're just here laying this out and we want to hear your comments. We're not the decision makers on this. It's going to be up to the government. And so
what were some of the alternate solutions that, for various places, what, not necessarily matching them to the places, but...
Well, some branch lines were just taken up completely. Others, just part of the line was taken up. Some on the middle of the line was taken up, and they sort of used a branch, stub ends on either way. And each one was quite interesting, because they had been set up as grain-dependent lines, which meant they got money from the federal government to keep these lines open. But a couple of them were not mainly used for grain. The railways were running other traffic over them, but that didn't count. So they would get a subsidy for, and fees for keeping the track going there. And let's say we ran into two of those cases, and out of those six, or one, both of them were used mainly for other things rather than grain, even though they were getting subsidies for hauling grain, and the branches were kept open for hauling grain. But
they weren't necessary for
that.
Hmm.
I think we had the line between Dauphin and Swan, Swan River. And in the middle there, it's mostly forested area and some ranching, livestock in there, very little grain. There's pretty good grain on both ends, next to Dauphin and then next to, from Minnetonus into Swan River. But in between there was a large stretch of track and there was very little grain delivered in that area. And yet it was being kept up as a grain point. But mainly it was, the CNR was running pulp and stuff across that line as a shortcut going east.
So it wasn't all to the advantage of the railways then? As the
There were different things. And I know I had a farmer right after we wrote our report on that branch line. He was in the paper giving, the day after the report came out, saying this was just a snow job or cover job for the railways, and really. And about a week or two later, I saw him at a farm meeting, and he came running up to me, and he said, I'm sorry. He said, I didn't even have a chance to read the report before the reporters were after me. So I said, the usual line, the railways are... got somebody out there speaking for him or covering for him. And he said, I read it. It's, you laid it all out. It's all there, the whole story. And mm-hmm. he was quite happy with the report.
How long did that project last between sort of starting it up and sending the report in?
It was at least 6 months, and it might have been 9 or 10. Mm-hmm. I think it was all done within the 1 year at least anyway.
And that mm-hmm. report would be on record somewhere.
Oh, yes, sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Anything else strike you as memorable about that particular project?
Well, I remember one farmer got very angry at a meeting, and but early in the meeting he was giving the railways all sorts of gears for not doing good service, and at the end he was making a fiery speech about how they couldn't survive without the railroads, we shouldn't take it up. And I sort of pointed out to him, which was his, and he just stood up and walked out of the meeting. But
well, when you're faced with facts, right?
Yeah.
So you
yes.
realize that...
Yeah. But in general, it went quite well. And I think I was bought in to head this committee because the wheat board, I think, generally has a pretty good reputation among the farmers as being on their side of things and mm-hmm. looking at things, so... Say, I think for political reasons, they probably figured an ex-wheat board guy was a good one to send out there. Mm-hmm.
Send out to the firing line.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So, did you follow what came of the report, whether it was implemented pretty closely or ignored completely?
Well, we didn't make a firm
representation. Right.
Recommendation on mm-hmm. any one of those particular. We had about 5 alternates, or, I think, on each mm-hmm. one, on each of those branches, sort of. And I know, like the one that ran from Winnipeg to Riverton, they cut off the end of it from Gimli North. That part of it has been abandoned, and they were started to haul the grain into Arburg. Now, the line kept going because there's big distillers at Gimli. That's bringing in U.S. corn. Mm-hmm. That's a big part of their whiskey operation there. And so that line, this end of the line, is still existing. I'm not sure about the one on Swan River. I think it's still running. The strange thing about that one was that you had the federal government subsidizing this rail line between Dauphin and Swan River, and right beside it you had this Manitoba with the number one highway, a very good road. Two transportation systems where you probably only needed one, and everybody around there would have said they wanted the highway, not the railroad, if you told them they had to have a choice.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's kind of an interesting one to look at. But there are other lines I know have been completely abandoned. A couple of them, one in Saskatchewan is completely abandoned. The other one, I think, They abandoned one end of the line, and then they built a bit of a new line going west a few miles to hook onto the CPR, a CN point was connected to a CPR line. So there were different combinations that were possible, and they did move on. I think all of them have had some things done to them on those six lines, yeah.
And in the,
and there's many other lines involved since then.
Right, and the whole consolidation of the industry resulting in closing down of elevators.
Oh, yes.
Serviced by, so quite a major change.
Yes, when I first came to the wheat board, I was just amazed how many, I don't remember the exact numbers, but I don't know how many thousands of grain elevators there were in Western Canada. I'm sure they're under 1,000 today.
Yes, for sure.
It might even be 600 or something.
Yeah,
I'm not sure.
And all of those attached to a line. So,
yeah.
It might have been some major changes even beyond that.
I would have probably, if you'd asked me to make a recommendation, I would have recommended that some of those branches be kept open, but not the elevators, and you just use them as direct producer loading spots for producers can make them, or save themselves a lot of money if they load their own cars. Some like to do it, some don't.
Mm-hmm. Well, and sort of my limited experience or talking to people, there seems to be an upsurge in the producer cars for just the reason you mentioned.
Well, I always thought it would come faster than it has.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Because most of the farmers had pretty good trucks and augers, and but the weather, of course, is something you have to battle with.
Mm-hmm. Was there ever any discussion at the time of, talk about railway subsidization, which is pretty apparent, as opposed to road subsidization, and as you get increased use of the roads for trucking grain to other locations. Was that ever part of the equation?
Oh, sure. And we had meetings with the provincial people and what was going to happen to their roads, and oh yes, and they would make estimates on what it was going to cost them, so that this was part of the numbers that were put into the thing, you know.
Sounds like this study was very well designed.
Yeah, I think it was designed about as well as you could do at that time, and I say Mike Chomsky was very good at putting all this together, and the railways people providing their numbers, and getting numbers from the provincial people and the elevator people, and so yeah, I was fairly pleased at how well it did work out.
Mm-hmm.
I knew it wasn't going to be a popular thing anyways, but it was something that was going to have to be done.
So you were working as a private consultant at that time?
Yes, that was, yeah. So I had a contract with the government for that project.
Mm-hmm. And
with GTA, yeah.
And from there?
I also did another one for the GTA on looking at direct shipments to the U.S. Gulf first, and I was trying to line up a trial run of a solid or unit train of grain for the wheat board to put down there and to have a customer at the U.S. Gulf ports pick it up, and just to see what all might be involved. We had concerns about when you don't have the Grain Commission inspectors at the terminals, and oh, there are many, many questions about what could or go wrong or could happen. And had it all pretty well set up, and the buyer on the other end backed out of the thing, and we never did it. Mm-hmm. Never got done, but anyway, I looked at that one.
Seemed wise to do
an actual run.
Well,
that was going to be an actual run, that one. Mm-hmm. We got pretty close, but
And you had said something about that in the previous interview, that because we were talking about the long-term prospects for the Port of Thunder Bay and versus Duluth and to Louisiana. So,
yes.
Given recent changes in the politics of the nation, I think we might be having a lot more of these test runs.
I don't know. It depends. Because the board has changed now. You've got the farmers supposedly in control of the board. You've got they got the majority of the members. And so, yeah, it'll be some interesting times now with the government seeming to have one view of things and the elected farmers another idea. But
we wait.
In general, that's been quite a shift in the industry over the years. First we went to an elected advisory committee, and then we got the, before they had been appointed by the government as well as the as commissioners. And so that was a big step forward to have each region having their own elected member. We had 11 or 12 of them. And then we used to go out and have meetings in their particular districts, all day meetings, answering questions, which they chaired, the local fellow chair. So we started putting out a lot more information and meeting face-to-face with a lot more farmers after that. But then it's gone on since then. At that time, of course, now you have the elected board. But you have 15 members and 5 are appointed by the government and 10 are elected. And that's a little different. Mm-hmm. So that's where you get clashes, I guess, now. And
all of that is under the federal government legislation. So you change the legislation and you can pretty much...
Oh, they can do whatever. Then they change legislation.
They
found they couldn't do it just by regulation. If you change the act, you can change a lot. Mm-hmm. You can't change everything by regulation very much. But yeah.
So between the work with the GTA and the grain marketing, Western Grain Marketing Panel, was that? Mm. I think that was the title.
Yeah, I guess
of
that
it.
Was called that.
How did you become involved in that one? And what do you recall about it?
Well, I spent, in between there, I spent 2 years in Saskatoon at the University of Saskatchewan as a visiting prof.
Oh.
So I was there for a couple of years, and then I came back. And
well, let's, before you go on then to the grain marketing panel, what did you teach at the University of Saskatchewan?
Grain marketing. Well, I used to sit in on other classes, both with the VOCAG classes in the wintertime and with different people. Anybody could invite me into their class, or I'd give lectures and somebody was gone. Or
so this was in the Faculty of Agriculture, I would assume?
Yeah, economics. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so talk about a career sort of going, you know, starting in one area and almost ending in another area. What did you notice any difference between the students in your first stint as a professor and the time in Saskatchewan?
Great deal of difference.
Say something more about that.
Maybe I was more different than they were.
Probably both. But
yes,
yeah. Say more about what you noticed about the difference in. It would have been a different country to begin with.
As a young professor, I knew a lot of things. As an older one, I wasn't so sure of myself what I was going to be professing, so I wasn't probably quite as made things quite as interesting or as exciting as I might have in the earlier days. But I had students at 8 o'clock in the morning for an hour and a half, and half of them were asleep, I think. So it wasn't, I just didn't have the best pick of times in that. But, and you'd have, I don't know, 40, 50 students, I forget what it was in a particular class, but there were several of them I got to know quite well, and who would come around and talk to me outside of class. That was always very good, and they would write papers, you had to term papers and things, you had them write. And one of them ended up in the grain trade and other substantial jobs, both with Archer Daniels Midland in the U.S., and then later he was at the Wheat Board for a while, and also with Saskatchewan Wheat Pool. So that was one of the good parts. And also when I was there, my next-door office partner was Ward Wiesenthal, who is now the Chief Operating Officer of the Wheat Board. So... he's a very good fellow, and he, I'd say I'm quite pleased with the way he's worked out at the Wheat Board.
Could you tell sometimes it's difficult to have interaction with the students, except for those that will interact with you outside of the classroom. Could you tell anything about their philosophy of grain marketing, how they felt about the way things are or should be?
They were pretty well mixed, I would say. I suppose in there, in teaching grain marketing, I taught open marketing as well as wheat board. That was all part of it. And having been from the U.S., not telling them, you know, everybody gets used to their own poison, but there's good parts and there's others that aren't. And anyway, so I don't know. No, there were none of them that I remember ever would strongly want to get up and debate one side or the other. They were a little too sleepy or something in the morning. I don't know.
They hadn't been in the real world yet.
Well, it was better when I went to the Volk Ag boys who were there in the wintertime, and they were regular farmers. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, there I got more reaction than I did out of the degree people. Yes. Because of the degree people, some of them were more interested in livestock, and grain was marketing, maybe one of their electives, I don't know. So I didn't get as... Well, no, the Volk Ag fellows who were in there for 3-4 months in the wintertime, yeah, they were much more interesting, and they wanted to know all about rail line abandonment and quotas and all the operation, day-to-day operation things, yeah.
It had a real impact on
them. Those were very good, yes. I also tried to get out to little marketing clubs and also to very district pool meetings and things like this. And some of these were very open market-oriented clubs. And then there were some of the other. The wheat pool was not particularly happy to have me there, I don't think. I didn't get invited to too many of theirs.
Why would you say that was?
Well,
speculating.
It's hard for me to say. I think when I was at the wheat board, I wasn't considered political in any way, left, right, or any. Mm-hmm. And so nobody really... I hoped I looked at it as just a professional marketing guy, and this is the way we get things done. But I don't think any of them really, some of them thought I was a little too pushy, that the wheat board was trying to take over and do too many things, and I thought they were rather dragging their feet and pretty slow on a lot of things. It was only when they were in big trouble we could get some action. But so I had different reactions from them.
Were they in a time of expansion then, or were they?
They hadn't really made up their minds yet at that time. They were still, I remember when the Cargill people came in, they were very worried about this. And I said, you just take care of your own business. And don't worry about them, you know. They're just ordinary people like the rest of us, and they're in Canada, and they got to abide by the Canadian rules and system, and they will. And I don't know, some of them didn't like that, I guess, that sort of idea. Also, I'd push for expansion of the terminals at Vancouver, and they thought I was pushing a little too hard. And one of them gave me a little lecture one day that the Sass Pool was the big dog in the grain trade, not the wheat board, and we were the hard men. Mm. But anyway... It was kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't think they had a big enough broad view and enough forward-looking view in there. They needed to be shook up a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, things did get shook up, as you said.
And I was, you have the people who say if something's not broke, don't fix it. I was always, change is good for the change, just mm-hmm. keep things moving and stay on the offense, keep things moving. And that wasn't too popular with some of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, they were a large organization.
Oh, yes, very.
Yeah. And, so even within their own
and they had their own farm directors and that they had to try and bring along. And mm-hmm. So they had a... I had one of them one day say how fortunate I was at the wheat board. I didn't have a board of directors I had to answer to. And I said, well, I've got 4 other commissioners who have access to all the same people and all the information I have, and they know exactly what questions to ask and all this and that. I said, you bring in your farm directors once a month and you tell them this is this, and what are they going to say? Well, anyway.
Well, I have found that, in my experience anyway, that until you actually have worked on the other side, you don't really have a good sense of what people are up against. And well, everybody's up against their own challenges. They're just just different challenges.
Yeah.
So when you came back then to Manitoba, was it to work on the green marketing?
No. Came back and I was more or less by that time thinking I was getting close to full retirement. And if some possibilities picked up, I could work on them. Well, while I was at the university, before I went to the university and while I was there, I was also on the advisory committee to Ottawa on first the U.S.-Canadian Free Trade Agreement, and then on the Uruguay round of the GATT. So I was on a technical committee for the, what they called a Industry Technical Committee for Agriculture and the U.S.-Canadian Free Trade Negotiations. And then on the next one, I was on the upper policy level sort of advisory group to John Crosby, who was minister at that time of trade.
Now, you were involved in the green trade agreements prior to this as well, in the earlier
yes.
years, as
yes.
I recall from our
yes.
conversations.
Yes.
So this was at the time of NAFTA, or NAFTA was just getting its feet wet? Or this was part of the whole NAFTA?
Well, this was at the start of the North American Free Trade Agreement, or the U.S.-Canadian part
mm-hmm.
of it anyway. Yeah. And then later they added Mexico in and called it North American Free Trade NAFTA.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the first piece then, before we went into the sort of upper policy one. So what can you tell me about those negotiations, the cut and thrust of international cooperation, or?
Well, I wasn't on the actual negotiating team. We were just advisors in Ottawa, and then they had their own negotiating teams. I knew the people in agriculture, of course, but I thought the interesting part when I first went in there is I was just appointed as an individual, I wasn't representing the wheat board or mm-hmm. any particular organization.
This would have been what year, just for mm-hmm. For trying to track down some background information, approximately?
Must have been about 88 when I started on that, and about 92 when I was through with those two groups.
Okay.
I think I was on there about 4 or 5 years. This is non-paying. I paid my expenses. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
See, I wasn't getting to get a big fee or anything for doing that. So, when I first went into this agriculture, this first technical meeting, many of them thought, because I was shown as an ex-commissioner of the wheat board, that I would be protecting the wheat board, I guess. And many of them on the supply management side of things, they were quite concerned what was going to happen to them if this U.S. border would open up. And they thought, well, the wheat board would surely be the one who would be the first one to take the lead and say, you can't do this and this and this. And I didn't take that approach. My approach was, well, here's one of the wealthiest, biggest markets in the world, and up to this point, we've been so limited on grain, we can hardly get anything across that border. There's some good possibilities, because I knew we had the quality of grain and standards that you didn't have in the U.S. and that millers would like. That was a big... And so I just thought, well, let's see where we can go with this thing. And this sort of upset, I think, some of the people and some of these other agricultural industries, particularly when I remember the grape and the wine people. And because they just thought they were going to be ruined if this border opened up. And now you go back and look at that, and it was really woke those guys up, and they got on top of their game. And nowadays, they're very proud of the wines they're producing and their markets they're developing. And mm-hmm. so.
And some and the, Eastern marketing boards, too, I think, were.
Oh, yeah, they were concerned.
Yeah, really.
But they, I don't know, the dairy and the
poultry
people, they stayed protected, so they haven't changed them that mm-hmm. one very much. But it did open up substantial marketing drain for the wheat board and the rest of the Canadian Western industry.
Now, if I recall correctly, when we were talking about your early involvement in the grain talks, there was it the Kennedy round, the round that
yeah.
went nowhere.
On grain.
on grain, and I think I'm not sure about the others, but in your mind, this particular round. Later in your career was a much more successful round.
Well, and this bilateral one with the U.S.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because as I recall, it was the U.S. that sort of fell down on their part of the bargain in the earlier one.
Yes. They got sort of locked into a position, mm-hmm. say, for political reasons.
Would you say that from your position as an advisor to the Canadian group, the U.S. is how was Trudeau put it, the mouse and the elephant, because they are such a major player and such a major trading
mm-hmm.
Partner for Canada. How can they negotiate equally in such unequal positions? Like, what's in it for the states, I guess, in these situations? I can see what's in it for Canada, but what's in it for the states?
Well, they preached free trade for the world, and then when they'd get into things, they'd start to see some of their own programs being put under the pressure and their local groups getting upset. And they would have to shift ground. And it was a very, very difficult position for them. But they are big. And I used to tell our guys, it's like if you go to a dance, these guys have hired the band, and whatever music they play, you've got to outdance them if you want the girls. You know, and they're going to change the music on you whenever they feel like it, too. And, because
so
if they negotiate something and then they feel like they don't want it,
mm-hmm.
it's like de Gaulle talked about, treaties are like a rose, they last while they last.
Interesting.
Yes.
Interesting comment.
Yes.
Very astute, I'd say.
Yes.
So
if you're the big dog anyway, that's the way it can be. Yes.
So what would they get out of the free trade agreement related to the grain market?
They got very little, I would say, on the because during the bilateral U.S.-Canadian agreement, they didn't pay much attention to the grain on the U.S. side, really, because they had this Uruguay round coming up, and they assumed the grain was going to be dealt with there, and they didn't think they were going to let it go very far there. But as the U.S.-Canadian agreement came around, they had to submit it to the GATT in order for them to approve it as a bilateral arrangement. Because GATT's supposed to be multilateral to everybody, and if you have two parties involved here, they had certain conditions that should be met. And one of them was that it should be very comprehensive. And so when it came down to the end of it, they had to have something in there for grain, which they didn't really want. But it got thrown in, and I say, I think Canada got a break on that one.
So what advantage did Canada get out of that then?
Well, got access to the U.S. market. Mm. Got away from having a quota of what, less than 1 million bushels a year to, 500 million bushels or something.
And has that continued, as far as you know?
Yeah, there's still have regular trades there. I couldn't tell you the exact numbers right now. Mm-hmm. I haven't followed them, but no, they've been selling on a regular basis to a lot of the large mills down there.
So the this one stuck. This
yeah.
round of
yeah, that
of negotiations stuck.
Yeah, that part of it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
They still haven't multilaterally through the GATT gone as far as they could, but. No, the U.S. gained mostly on the industrial and the side of things in that Kennedy round. That was the big thing they were after in that one, and to open up Europe and some European markets and Japan. And so that was where the big things were for them. And they made progress on that.
And in this round, they made progress on just
well,
the whole.
They're on another round by now, third one. What do they call this one? I forget.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That's going very far. You don't hear much about it.
Mm-hmm. So
because the U.S. has gotten more concerned about their own jobs and their sort of isolationist tendencies creeping in down there, and they're beginning to question, I think, some of their own free trade. Now you don't hear them say free trade very often. They say they want fair trade,
mm-hmm.
which means they want to keep their markets.
Yeah. And certainly they have bigger concerns than Canada.
Oh, yes, sure.
In that regard.
Yes.
So the higher level group then, was that the group that then dealt with the grain issue?
It was everything. Yeah. And
so what were they trying to accomplish?
Well, this was on the Uruguay round, and this was supposed to be an international.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess they were trying to revive the. There wasn't much done in grain, actually. I'd say there wasn't a heck of a lot accomplished on grain under that round at all. So I can't point out any
mm-hmm.
great development that.
Yeah. In the
I can remember coming out of that one for as far as grain was concerned.
Yeah. In the intervening years of your first. Trade talks, and I recall at that point there was the European Union, I think, in those early years was really subsidizing.
Oh, yes.
But things had changed there, too.
Some, anyway. I don't know. I don't know their position right now that
mm-hmm.
well.
But I guess what made me say that.
We've had higher grain prices in general in recent years and things, so. But
and their subsidies just kicked in when?
Well, if you have low world prices, that's when they would kick in. But the biggest, so where they're at right now, I couldn't tell you.
Mm-hmm. Then on to, before we move from that, though, in both of those cases, in the Canada-U.S. free trade, and the Uruguay round, things like the Wheat Board and the Canadian Grain Commission as potential subsidies and so on, they were left alone.
Yeah, the U.S. always had certain, was trying to push to get rid of, say, like boards, like
mm-hmm.
the Australian and the Canadian board. The Australian board is pretty well changed. But whenever the U.S. would challenge, they had a number of challenges after that bilateral agreement and the Canadian grain started moving. I think they had 6, 7 or more challenges in there, trying to say that the wheat board was undercutting the market or doing
mm-hmm.
something. And the panels had looked at that back Canada on every one of them.
Mm-hmm.
So
probably only outnumbered by the lumber.
Oh, yeah, that might be. But the big thing, I think, with the U.S. was that the people importing this from some of the biggest grain outfits in the world, let's say Archer Daniels and Cargill and
mm-hmm.
Continental, and they have a lobbyist and they wanted it to keep coming.
mm-hmm. Good. Allies in
yeah.
in good places.
Yeah.
So then, was your next stint then with the grain marketing panel?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, as in Ralph Goodale was the minister at that time. When he somebody called me up and asked
was
me.
That the li- was that the Liberal?
Yes.
Okay.
They were Liberals, yeah.
And how had you met him previously?
He had, well, he had been in Parliament as a young fellow and as a, assistant to Otto Lang, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yes. And so, yeah, that's when I first met him. Then he lost his seat in Saskatchewan, and then he went and he worked for Hayes and Argue when the Senator Argue was made the minister responsible for the wheat board. They didn't have any elected members in Western Canada, so they took Senator Argue out of the Senate and made him a minister. And then Goodale worked for him. And as did the fellow who used to work for me at the wheat board, he went to work for, he's in Argue, Terry Martin. And so I got to know him on a more personal basis then when he was working with Terry, because I knew Terry very well. He and I had worked close together for many years. And, but anyway, I'm trying to remember the circumstances where that panel came about. Your ice skating, there was pressure from the Western wheat growers, of course, wanting to look at things differently and see what can be done. And so I guess they were probably pushing for a panel to look at this again. I don't know, we've had how many of them over the years, but I think there were, it must have been 10 or 12 of us on that mm-hmm. committee. Murray would have
yes.
told you more about that
yeah.
than I did. But I think we hired him as the executive director or something. Or
mm-hmm.
say he sort of run, managed the show and, well, he had the chairman from Saskatchewan, a lawyer. We took a very legalistic approach to our committee, which was quite foreign to me.
How would you describe a legalistic approach?
When we had meetings, we were not supposed to express our own opinions. We were just supposed to listen and ask questions. Mm. We weren't supposed to put forward any ideas or engage really. In.
So you had the public meetings?
Yeah, we had
okay.
public meetings.
So it was at those meetings, not just your sort of private panel meetings?
Oh, no. Yeah, we were there mainly for public meetings, I would say.
And to answer questions. Because otherwise, why be there?
We weren't supposed to express our opinions very much.
Oh, okay.
I was hoping when we started that just by having our group together that we would interact and come up with. You know, there were some pretty good people on that panel. But the chairman, he didn't want us out floating ideas or suggesting this is something that should be looked at or tried. So
quite a different approach than the rail line
abandonment
one.
Much. And so I was very disappointed in that committee, except I kind of knew at the beginning we were put there to buy time for the government, to give them time to try and think through what line they wanted to take on it. I'd say mainly we were going out there saying they've got people looking at it, but I don't know that anything seriously was taken from the report that was written.
There were some recommendation related to the constitution of the Canadian Wheat Board.
Oh, yeah, I guess we did make some. Yeah, that may have been.
More farmer representation.
Yeah, well, that an elected board of directors and that, which was, I always thought was fine. Say the more democratic you made it, the better. That was one thing that always bothered me. I didn't want to be appointed a commissioner. I didn't like the idea of appointments like that, but I was sort of pressured into it. So I always liked the idea when they got first the elected advisory committee, and then the other, it kept progressing, which I thought was good. You know, as long as we had our own professional staff and kept them out of the politics side, mm-hmm. then these board of directors should take care of the politics and deal with the government mainly on that. But.
So mainly a stopgap measure?
Yeah, I say I think it just bought them time while they were trying to think through a position that they wanted to take on things.
Anything in particular as you sat through the delegation presentations? Anything sticks in your mind about the various groups and their presentations? Any surprises? Pretty much predictable? What would you say?
No, it was all quite predictable, I think. I can only remember one or two incidents that have been interesting.
Can you share those? The interesting
one was
incidents?
With Paul Earle.
Okay.
He was there, I think, working with the United Grain Growers at that time.
Okay.
Well, and he made some kind of a little speech about something. And he's a very serious minded fellow, as you know. You've worked with him?
I have not met him. We haven't interviewed him yet. He's on our list.
Oh. He's a very bright guy. And he got his views pretty fixed on a lot of things. He made something, and I responded to something or asked him some questions about it. And he started getting red in the face, and he was getting a little... And I said, Paul, you don't need to debate that. I agreed with you. And he, somebody from the wheat board agreed with him, or he still thought of me as wheat board, I suppose. I agree with the board. But, and that kind of rattled him a little bit, I remember.
The makeup of the panel is Mr. Cormack was outlining for me at the interview that we had with him. Appeared to try to strike a balance of interests.
Oh, yes, everybody was. That's true.
The eventual coming together of the report, given the predictability of the delegations' presentations and the differences in viewpoints of the people on the panel, how easy was it to put the report together?
It wasn't a very meaningful report in my view. It was pretty loosely hung together in order to get an agreement. And even at that, it wasn't. Almost to the last day, I threatened to write an independent report and file it. But, because one of them wanted to, after we had agreed this was finally the wording we were going to use, one of them, the last morning, wanted to change some things in it. And I just said, well, I'm not signing it if we change one word. This was finished yesterday, and that's that. And if the rest of you want to go along with making changes, I'll write my own report.
So what would you have...
But he did sign it.
Yeah. What would you have liked to have seen come out of that?
Oh. I would like to see them come out with something trying voluntary pooling and opening up for the wheat board to take on canola under voluntary pooling as well. And I always thought we could make voluntary pooling work, and there were very few people in the industry who ever thought that. And I still think that, but, and I've sent papers into the last couple of boards on it, but suggesting the outline of what I thought would be a real test for a few years on both. But
so how could that work?
Well, what I was suggesting is they take barley and canola and open up the barley from the wheat board side to voluntary pooling, and at the same time bring in the canola.
Interesting.
Yeah. And neither side would like it completely. but they both learned a lot from it. And but things have changed, you know, and with the fewer farmers and bigger farmers and all this and that, you can organize these things and you can give them more choices with the computers about when and where they want to deliver. And if they make an agreement that they'll deliver a portion of their crop or something, then the wheat board can still go out and make long-term sales commitments on those basis. And the wheat board is well enough established in both the world and in Western Canada to do that nowadays. In the earlier years, no. But now, it's quite different, I think. And I think you could have more teeth in the agreements between the farmers and the board so that they would live up to their contracts or their general agreements. And I think a large part of the farmers, even in canola, would favor pooling on a voluntary basis. To me, it's like mutual accounts or mutual funds. No, I don't know if you know mutual funds or not, but I don't like to particularly follow particular companies in the markets day to day and minute by minute. So I use mutual funds. It's just pooling. Because I, you know, and out there, the farmers, I don't think there's more than 10-15% of them who really would want to stick watching the markets every day to day. And even if they did, they don't have enough inside information. They're always going to be late and out of the game. Mm-hmm. So I think most of them are more interested in straight farming or in mechanics and welding and many interests, curling, whatever, than they are in trying to sit and watch that computer every day. Well, there's some of them that are interested in it, and some of them might do all right, but not very many. Mm. So I think it would be, a lot of them, I think, would like to pool canola. Mm. And the wheat board, given a big supply of canola, could make bigger contracts than any of the individual companies nowadays can, which would be of interest, because I think I mentioned that to you last time. Right? When the Frito-Lay people in the United States, the chip people, the biggest users of cooking oil in the United States, and they're part of the Pepsi people, which is, they got the big pizza places, PepsiCo, it's a whole empire. They were serious about looking in canola, and they couldn't find enough supplies to make it worth their while to go out and really push and publicize that they had this better oil they were using. And I said they had a guy on it.
Lost opportunity.
I say they had a guy on it for a couple of years. And then he looked at contracting acreage in the different places in the States and acreages here and talked to the different companies, and he couldn't come up with a big enough supply. Hmm. That's a number of years back.
Yeah.
Oh, I was also on a canola marketing committee too once.
Oh, okay.
Oh, and I wrote this up in a report. It got stuck in the appendix because nobody else would agree with me on it. A couple of them kind of agreed with me, but they said, look, this is such a popular thing with everybody. Everybody knows canola is a big success. You know, they're going to laugh if we come out with this, that the wheat board could do this and this with it. Hmm? Anyway.
So that was through the Canola Association?
Well, this is another government.
Oh, another government.
Government committee.
Yeah. So where would all these nuggets be filed? Department of Agriculture, Department of Trade? Do you have them in your file?
Oh, yeah, I have them all.
Oh, good. So you'll make sure that we get a copy of them at some point.
Well, I don't have extra copies.
But when the time, or the other thing is, we can actually scan them and return them to you.
If you're going to set up a little library, I might give them to you someday. The whole works, I don't know.
Good. We are hoping to.
Burning them,
No, please. Do not do that. Unfortunately, I'm afraid of all of the stuff that gets tossed, never to be found again. You know, the files get too full. Who was this guy anyway? And they just toss it out. So, anyway,
I could tell you, when I wasn't too long with the wheat board, I had a long evening discussion with a very fellow I really respected a lot, and still do. And I was trying to get him to come to the wheat board. And he said, no. He said, I started out as a poor farm boy and I'm going to make some money and make a little reputation. He said, you're just going to end up at the wheat board as a faceless wonder who never made any money.
So did this person make his fame and fortune?
Yeah.
Oh, did he? Huh? His name will not be mentioned on tape?
No.
Well, unless there are any other little nuggets in your that you'd like to add to our history, I'd like to go on to ask just a few general questions. We have slightly under half an hour left, and
well, I had one other assignment.
Okay.
World Bank.
Oh, let me just move this a little closer. So tell me how you got involved at the World Bank and what you did there. When was this, the World Bank?
Well, the first time was shortly after I left the Weed Board. Charlie Mayer was the minister, and he had been invited to a World Bank thing in Argentina, and he couldn't make it, a symposium of some sort, and he asked me if I would go. So I did. And it's a great country, Argentina, and you look at it, it's a beautiful farm country. I'd been there before, and had business and meetings with the Argentina wheat boards and their board of trade and all those people. Anyway, they were having this conference on how to make their grain handling and things more efficient and all of this. So this is why Mr. Mayer asked me to take it over for him. And I went and had these meetings. And then the Argentinians wanted to have a separate meeting one morning with their efficiency committee or something. And so I said, well, I've got something coming up at noon, and the afternoons are full. But okay, we'll meet about 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. Well, nobody meets at 8 o'clock in the morning. Finally, I forgot them to 10:30 or 11, I forget. And at that time, I think two were there out of about eight. And just about the time I was ready to leave, the rest of them showed up. Maybe that's the way to live, that manana style of life, but you can't. It's a tough way to run a railroad. But anyway, that was just a very brief, but it was an exposure to some of the World Bank people, I guess. And then
What is their impact on the grain industry?
Well, grain is a very minor thing in their thing, but they get involved in all these economies trying to help them develop and make changes, or they won't lend them money. And
Such as this Argentinian efficiency.
Yeah, there were supposed to be some, they had made some application, I guess, to the World Bank for some kind of developmental funds for grain transportation. And so I don't know. But anyway, then later after the Southern Committee of Murray's, then I got approached by them to go to Russia. And this was when Gorbachev was Gorbachev out already, I guess, at that time. But they'd been in this big transition, and they were trying to move to an open market. And the World Bank was in there. And they had big questions about all the wastage there was in the system, and where was the big problems, and all this. And so, I was there for about 2 months, I guess, traveling in the country and meeting with different groups. And they had a tremendous rail line, they had tremendous terminals, and they had very good hopper cars. And I couldn't understand this big wastage factor they always had over there. They said they produced these big crops, but then, and it was quite an experience. And I think they were overbuilt. But they didn't trust farm storage. And so they thought they had to grab everything at harvest time and put the army in there and everybody else. People shouldn't have been trying to handle grain or anything, but they tried to rush it in and get it into these terminals by the cities as fast as they could, so they knew they had it sewed up. And then if they couldn't get enough, then they would import. And
Say they didn't trust storage, they felt it
on
would,
the farm.
It was
they didn't trust it on the farm.
Or just the quality of the storage, or where it might end up if it didn't get
it out. They just didn't think they'd ever see it, I guess.
Okay.
And total, they weren't. once they got it into their terminals and that, they handled it pretty well, and the storage, their standards were pretty good on grain. They copied the grain commissions mainly. Yeah, I think to a large extent. The grain commission has a tremendous reputation around the world as quality standards and such. And a very important part of this whole Canadian wheat marketing structure. I say it's at least as important as the wheat board has ever been in that. And,
Were their terminals similar to ours?
Yes.
They look like ours?
Yeah, big cement silos and things like this. Hmm. But I say they tried to have them close to the cities and get as much food as they could. And I was trying to make a point with them that they need to have farm storage and maybe pay them something and then have them deliver it as you need it during the year, rather than trying to rush it all in a couple of months. And then with these army trucks, you're going to get wastage and you're going to get all this and that. And I met the top group. They were a very good bunch of people. And they were the ones who actually gave the buying export club their orders when they could buy or when they could sell grain. They were the overall responsibility for this grain supply for all of Russia. And there were about 8 or 10 guys, and it reminded me of some of the early guys I used to know on the wheat board when I first met them. Very responsible, very serious fellows about their job. And I had a really good afternoon with them. And the one World Bank guy was sitting with me, he's from India. He said, I never heard him talk so openly before. He said, they threw the export club, they had a certain amount of respect for the wheat board, and then I think I have a talking language they understood. But I was trying to tell them how, if they could just bring it in from the farms when they needed it, rather than having all the super extra. And they couldn't understand a quota. To them, a quota was an order. You bring in the grain. And to have a quota that you open and then the farmers bring it in, what? How can you rely on that? You know, we got to be responsible for having this food, mm-hmm. You know.
Well, I'm making it worth the farmer's while to hold it, too. So, the whole system.
Yes.
And when you consider the length of time that it took the wheat board to develop its system, which was running quite smoothly, but that was between the period of 45 and what, 85, 95, before it really,
35,
before it was running, worked the kinks out of it. Hmm.
But anyway, they were...
So did they make changes? Did you follow up on...
Well, they didn't follow the line that I recommended, but they've made changes on it. And I'd be interesting to go back down to see where they are. Mm-hmm. They've done some things that have changed because they started exporting even some, particularly the Ukraine. So,
mm-hmm. So you wrote a report for the World Bank then for that?
Mm-hmm.
So that also was in your collection?
That was a public paper, though.
Yeah.
That was never a public one. Hmm. I had suggested they come in and get somebody like the Wheat Pool and some of the other big international houses to come in there and, they could invite them into their company or their country on some sort of a long-term agreement and gradually show them how to run a system.
Mm-hmm.
But they never quite bought into that.
No.
Because I think they had ideas about how they could chop up the system for their own advantage, certain some of them.
Yes.
And they were being taught they were supposed to be capitalists, so.
That was their definition of it.
Yeah, I know. One day, a couple of them asked if I'd go to lunch with them. And they said the World Bank people wanted to do a big survey and try to determine position of stocks and all that, and movements and all this and that. And the guy said, under our old system, we've got all these numbers in our computers now. We don't have to make surveys. We've got all the actual numbers.
Mm.
But what should we do with it? Should we tell these guys that, or is there a way we can sell this to them? Or
yeah. Yeah.
A good question.
Well, a good question.
Yeah, we're supposed to be capitalists now.
And that was a lot of resources putting together and gathering information.
Well, I go through all this business and then try to do it with just big huge surveys, which we wouldn't have much confidence in anyway.
Yeah. I think this is fitting to move on to some general questions, because as I recall, when you were when you first started out and you were doing that summer project at the USDA, you were suspicious a little bit about some of the statistics.
You always have to get a little suspicious statistics, but you also have to know a lot of them.
Yeah.
So you can have things in proportion and
yeah.
See the context.
So I'm going to ask you a couple of sort of wrap-up questions. And one is, as you think back on all of the stuff that you have done over your career, which is quite quite amazing, could you pick one that you were most proud of? It could be the smallest thing, or it could be sort of an amalgamation of all the things. I don't know.
The smallest thing?
Well, no.
Well, I can think of a very small one that gives me great pleasure. When I see these logos on these grain cars. My friend and I designed that. I don't even roll the paper on that one. And I'd like to say we did it over a cup of coffee. No, we'd hired Dave Sitterman to come in and be our first PR, or information officer. We never had one before. And we wanted to put out a newsletter on a regular basis and all this, and one of the first things he said is we needed to have a logo or a brand, you know, for people to recognize. And he made this pitch to me. I was the executive assistant to the board yet at that time. He made this pitch to me, and I said, well, Dave, I know that the CN has recently paid guys $50,000 to design that wiggly worm, as we used to jokingly call it. $50,000, I said, I can't go to the board and ask them to use $50,000 of farmers' money to design a logo. And I said, to me, logos aren't worth that much. Well, he still thought we needed a logo, so he started diddling with it himself. And anyway, one day he asked me to go to coffee with him, and then got out a serviette and he sketched out his idea, which is sort of like that. And I said, that's some possibilities, but I know the Australians have recently adopted a new one and it's very similar to that. I said, that doesn't, I don't think that will do. I said, on the front of our building, on the cornerstone, we have a head of wheat, sort of like this one here. And he said, oh, that's too much, too complicated, that's too busy. How about if we just add a couple more blooms up here? And I said, yeah, okay. And then I said, why don't we put the two lines in the middle for the beard? And that basically was it. And he took it to an artist friend of his, and he designed it. Then it got used on the board's letterheads and on our Grain Matters, that little publication we put out. Then Otto Lang grabbed onto it, and I put it on his stationery as minister responsible for the weed board. And then when he started buying hopper cars, he threw it on there, which we were glad to see. And
So you could have made your fortune as a graphic artist.
This is more Dave's than mine. Dave was the biggest part of this. But my grandkids say, there's grandpa's cars, and they see those. So something gives me a kick. A few years later, one time, when I asked the existing board, I was on the board at that time, that if they wouldn't give us a letter formally recognizing our role in creating this. And they got a little concerned, because I think they thought that we were trying to get some money out of them. So they gave it to our legal people, Henry Monk and his assistant, and they came back with a paper which they wanted us to sign, which we did. It just said, well, they've recognized us as the designers, but that this had been done as part of our duties. and there was no financial thing expected or such and such. But we were entitled to be the honorary holders of the copyright. The Wheat Board copyrighted it, and they recognized us as the honorary copyright.
For the historical.
Yeah, yeah. So we, yeah, we each got a letter with that.
Right.
So that was that.
Yeah.
Then after, in the 90s, after I was gone from there, they added the CWB on the bottom of it. So this is not always used. But that was kind of a fun thing.
We are hoping to get established a center in Thunder Bay under the Parks Canada banner to recognize the importance of the development of the export grain trade in Canada's development. And the focus would be the history part of it, but also sort of the intriguing science of the grain industry as well. If we are successful in accomplishing this, which is questionable, but what pieces from your experience with the grain trade do you think really should be front and center, recognized in a center such as that? We're hoping as well to attach it to a terminal elevator to preserve one of those as well as an iconic symbol.
One of the big things to me is quality control in Canada. That means you're marketing a product, not a commodity. And then with the Wheat Board having the monopoly supply of it in large quantities, and you could sell in bulk by shiploads and all this of consistent quality stuff. This was the big thing for Canada. And so the Grain Commission and the plant breeders, all of them, this equal to Marcus designation or standard they set for new varieties, controlling it from starting from there. And they kept out the, back in the 50s and 60s, there were all these, I call them these new short dwarf varieties came out and must be higher yielding, and the U.S. jumped into those, and that sort of jumbled up all their qualities, and they lost their consistency. And you know, so you had to look at it carload, or not even carload, but almost truckload by truckload, and test it and know how to, before millers and bakers knew how to use it. But that was really the backbone of that export system, I think. And then the reliability over the years of the, both the Wheat Board and the Grain Commission, and standing behind and dealing with customers if they had problems, and telling them in advance what new things were coming in each crop, how you might have to vary. You had meetings with, well, the big millers and bakers in Japan and Europe, and telling what certain variations might be coming with new crop and all this, but that would be very slight and it would be adjusted. And so there was great, I think, service. And then, well, the other one I'm very pleased with is the SIGI. That has also proven to be a great thing, better than I had imagined when we started it. But that has really been very good. And because people from around the world could come there and they could, we'd have people in lecturing, not only on, you know, Wheat Board in Canadian ways, but on the open market side of things. And the private grain companies here in Winnipeg sent their guys in to give talks, and the railways, and everything was concentrated here in Winnipeg. We could draw people in very quickly, and so that quickly caught on around the world, and all young executives wanted to get in on this course. And I say it really, and once you get to know people personally and they understand the Canadian system better, it was just a great educational thing, and as well as a very big PR kind of a thing too, as far as that goes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This may be rather a negative way to, it depends on your answer, I guess, a negative way to to end the interview, but those things that you mentioned certainly have come forward in majority of the interviews that we've conducted with the Winnipeg people. I think the people working in the trade, let's say at Thunder Bay, where we've also done a fair number of interviews, I don't think they realized how important what they were doing was to the success. But these also strike me as being the elements that are most likely to disappear in the next 10 years. And if so, what's the future of the grain trade?
Well, it's not nearly as important to the overall Canadian economy as it used to be. See, in the olden days, it was such an important segment of it that nobody wanted to mess it up too badly or do things. And But I would hope everybody realizes this quality control thing is important and they continue with that. There's talks about loosening it up, this and that, and reducing the amount of inspections here and there, but I think that would be a very backward step. And but of course now with the bigger acreages in canola and also with the feed grain exports we had, there isn't the dependence on just wheat as it was. And it may be with computers and that now, we can connect individual farmers almost with overseas buyers almost, and maybe they can get their assurances of quality that way. There could be lots of changes coming, but it's still a very good system, and I don't see it disappearing too quickly.
Well, it'll be interesting to watch, won't it?
Yeah, it will be, and it's just the grain business. It's not religion. It can change. I mean, some people out here take it as religion.
I think
they don't want to discuss facts. They got their mind made up one way or the other. And that's
it. Yes, which has its long-term disadvantages for any organization. So have you had a chance to say what you'd like to say? Have I asked the questions that allowed you to say what you want to say, or is there, in the couple of minutes remaining, is there anything you'd like to add?
Oh, I know all those.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. Well,
I suggested a board. They should let some of us go back into their files and look at correspondence and get dates and write up reports on a lot of these things that we were involved in some detail. But
well,
I've never had
a
positive response on that yet.
Yeah.
So.
Let me just officially close off the interview here by thanking you so much for the time that you've spent. I really appreciate it. And you've shown me quite a far different perspective than a lot of our other interviewees, narrators as we've officially called them, and I particularly appreciated your dual experience with the Canadian system and the American system and broad worldview. So thank you very much.
Well, I take sort of a macro view of things, I guess, rather than the micro, and that's why at the board I was involved in all aspects, and in some ways I was a troubleshooter when there was a problem in this area that be shunned over there for a while, and I like that. And it was never a dull moment. There were lots of little adrenaline rushes every day.
Great. Well, thanks again.
Yes, you're welcome.